I'm Anna Garcia with True Crime News, the podcast. Every crime tells a story. Every story demands justice. True Crime News, the podcast, covers breaking crimes, investigating high-profile and under-the-radar cases. Every week, we dive beyond the headlines, exploring the effects of violent crimes on victims and search for justice. We hope you join us as your weekly source for True Crime News. Listen to and follow True Crime News, the podcast, on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KNX News, 97.1 FM.
This is Countdown 2024.
Brought to you by LMU Loyola Law School.
Here are Charles Feldman and Margaret Carrero.
Well, 42 more days to go until the Trump transition becomes the second Trump administration. Thanks for counting down the days with us. On today's Countdown 2024, Elon Musk spent nearly $250 million of his own money to help Donald Trump get elected to the presidency. So now, what does he want in return for his investment? We'll look at Trump's cabinet stuffed with billionaires. And the president-elect says in an interview over the weekend that he will get rid of birthright citizenship on day one of his administration. But can a president do away with the constitutional amendment by the way of an executive order? But first, this.
President-elect Trump gave a news-filled interview to NBC's Meet the Press over the weekend, during which not only did he promise to end birthright citizenship, but also aggressively deport illegal immigrants, pardon all of the people arrested for storming the Capitol during the January 6th insurrection. He also said members of the Congressional January 6th committee should go to jail. In addition, Trump said he is sticking with his tariff strategy, and when asked if he could guarantee Americans that consumer prices won't be going up as a result of tariffs on foreign imports, he answered that he can't guarantee anything.
In spite of a ton of negative press and seeming skepticism on the part of several senators who will be called upon to ultimately confirm him, Pete Hegseth is hanging tough as Trump's pick to be the next Secretary of Defense. Hegseth met today with Iowa Republican Senator Joni Ernst, who is herself a military vet and seen as a key indicator of whether Hegseth actually has a chance of confirmation. Senator Ernst has been an outspoken advocate for protecting female soldiers from sexual assault and misconduct. And of course, Hegseth is accused of committing both of those acts.
Outgoing West Virginia Independent Senator Joe Manchin is introducing a resolution that calls for a constitutional amendment to institute non-renewable 18-year terms for new Supreme Court justices, with a new term starting every 2 years. Manchin says that the, and this is a quote, current lifetime appointment structure is broken and fuels polarizing confirmation battles and political posturing that has eroded public confidence in the highest court in our land. Manchin's Supreme Court term limit structure does have support among many legal scholars.
Elon Musk, the world's richest person, spent over $250 million to help Donald Trump get elected. And now the head of Tesla and SpaceX finds himself taking meetings with foreign diplomats and touring the halls of Congress on a mission to slash federal spending. But what else does Musk want from Trump and his investment in Trump? Max Chafkin is a columnist and a tech reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek. He also co-hosts the podcast Elon Inc. Max, thanks for being with us. Did I get that right, Chafkin?
Yeah, you got it.
Okay, hey. Very good. So how are you doing? So let's tackle the biggest and first question. Someone spends $250 million of their own money. It stands to reason they want something in return. What do you think he wants in return?
Well, yeah, and I should say just off the bat that Elon Musk has said he did this out of his, you know, personal conviction, not out of his desire to favor trade or anything like that. That said, I think the notion that he wants things from the incoming administration is absolutely correct. And I think you got to start with his government contracts. So Elon Musk, in addition to Tesla, runs a company called SpaceX, which is a giant defense contractor. They sell rocket launches to the U.S. government. U.S. government is their most important customer. So this is a guy who just off the bat is counting on the U.S. government for a huge part of his revenue. And there are ways, and Trump teased some of this stuff on the campaign trail when he talked about, you know, funding a Mars mission. A Mars mission would be very lucrative to Elon Musk. And then you can kind of go down the list. Elon Musk runs, you know, five companies, and they all do business with the U.S. government in one way or another. So SpaceX mentioned, Tesla Motors, you know, it's an electric car company, but it depends on essentially favorable tax treatment from the government and these and this scheme where it's able to trade credits to other automakers. Musk also runs the Boring Company, it's a tunnel digging company that could conceivably get government contracts. And the list kind of goes on and on. He is someone who's done a lot of business with the federal government over the years, and as a result has developed very strong ideas about what should happen over the next 4 years.
I mean, so he certainly, you know, stands to gain a lot from this partnership, if you will, with President-elect Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's already gained a lot, you know, by putting himself at the center of the campaign, by becoming this big surrogate. Musk, you know, really helped his social media company, X, which he bought for $44 billion and has had a lot of struggles over the last couple of years. You know, during the election, X saw, you know, there's a lot of energy around this. It became, you know, a really big part of the sort of news cycle. And so he's already helped himself. We've seen the value of Tesla Motors just soar over the last couple of months as investors anticipate some of these changes. And on the private markets, most of Musk's companies are traded in private markets, not publicly. There have also been investors marking up those investments. So on paper, he's already made billions of dollars. If you think, you know, $250 million, which is the number, it's probably a little bit more than that, the number that Musk gave politically, if you think that's a lot, I mean, you should look at the amount his net worth has increased since, you know, the November election. It's over $50 billion.
We're talking with Max Chafkin, columnist, tech reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek, also the co-host of the podcast, Elon Inc. Max, is there any indication that you were picking up that Elon Musk is becoming perhaps a bit of a pest to Trump? Because he seems to be showing up in every picture that Trump is in. And I get it, when someone spends $250 million, perhaps, you know, there's quite a bit of tolerance to that person. But is he maybe going a bit too far?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to. So there, you're definitely seeing reports out of Trump world, sort of grumbling from people around the president-elect that Musk is hanging around too much. And you've also seen Trump make a couple of cracks at various events, sort of joking that he can't get rid of Elon Musk and so on. And so there is sort of a conventional wisdom that these guys are both big personalities. They're both people who like to, you know, sit at the middle of the room to claim all the credit, to be the alpha or what have you. And it's inevitable that they're going to clash. Now, on the other hand, the thing that's cutting against that is the money, which is that Elon Musk has set himself up to be a very important political donor, you know, not just in the election that we just, you know, went through, but in the next midterm. He said he's going to, you know, be a big player there. So he is an asset to Trump as Trump looks to kind of corral, you know, potentially wayward Republicans. You mentioned Joni Ernst, you know, earlier. Like, he could fund a primary challenge for any Republican that doesn't kind of get with the program. And he's more or less said that's what he's going to do. So that's valuable to Trump. So even if Trump is maybe a little annoyed, like he can't get rid of Elon, Elon's always around, that, you know, Elon has that. And the other thing I'll say is we've seen a lot of signs that point to the contrary, that point to the idea that Trump really likes and respects Elon Musk, you know, right? Like he's spending a lot of time at Mar-a-Lago. You know, Trump is a big boy. If he wanted Elon to leave, he could make Elon leave, and he has chosen not to.
You know, I read one analyst predicted that Trump and Musk will fall out over China. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, that is a good thought, because Elon Musk has a lot of business interests in China. Tesla Motors is really dependent on its relationship with the Chinese government, both because it operates a large factory in China, and also because Musk sells a lot of cars in China. China is the biggest market for electric cars, so it's a very important market for him. Now, Trump, of course, has been this, you know, big China hawk, and it's really unclear how that will net out. We've seen some people in the Trump world, you know, just a couple years ago, like Steve Bannon and even Vivek Ramaswamy, criticize Elon Musk. And you know, what's happened is essentially he's been treated as a convert, treated as someone who's kind of come around to Trump's worldview. But what's unsaid is the point you just made, that there is a potential, you know, policy disagreement, which is that Musk has, you know, basically favored a pretty dovish position vis-a-vis China, and Trump has not. And so it's unclear how that will work itself out.
Because Musk is not occupying an official government position, what is the check on him? No pun intended.
I mean, the thing, what's interesting here is that DOGE, this is the Department of Government Efficiency. It's not actually a department, as you hint. It's more like a blue ribbon commission. Trump can sort of listen to what Musk is saying. Lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, can try to take this advice and use it to inform laws. But he doesn't have to go through a normal confirmation process. He's not going to leave the boards of his companies. He's not going to divest his financial interests. So, I mean, the check is basically political. It's Musk, you know, has a platform to express these very controversial opinions, to throw out these provocations on Twitter. And the question is, will Trump and will Republicans in the House and Senate go along with it? And I think there are real questions about how far they will go. A lot of the things that Musk has suggested are very unpopular. You know, he's talked about cutting $2 trillion from the budget. If you cut $2 trillion from the budget, you very quickly get to doing things that lawmakers of both parties are going to find, you know, politically unpalatable. So I think that the check is really politics. And what Musk has in his corner, again, is money, is the ability to spend a lot of money on upcoming elections to help Republicans or decline to do that. And that's going to be the leverage that he has.
Max Chafkin, columnist and tech reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek, co-host of the podcast Elon Inc. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Birthright citizenship enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, but Donald Trump says he wants to end that on his first day back in the White House. Can he? We'll talk about that next.
It's Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM. This is Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM.
Welcome back to the show. Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Margaret Carrero.
President-elect Trump told Meet the Press over the weekend that he remains determined to end the constitutional right for people born in the United States to automatically become U.S. citizens.
The 14th Amendment, though, says that, quote, all persons born in the United States are citizens. Can you get around the 14th Amendment with an executive action?
Well, we're going to have to get a change. We'll maybe have to go back to the people. But we have to end it. We're the only country that has it. You
through know. An executive action?
You know, we're the only country that has it. Do you know, if somebody sets a foot, just a foot, 1 foot, you don't need to, on our land, congratulations, you are now a citizen of the United States of America. Yes, we're going to end that because it's ridiculous.
Okay, we are going to look at both constitutional law and immigration law for this particular conversation. Melissa Murray teaches constitutional law at NYU. She is also co-host of the Crooked Media podcast, Strict Scrutiny. Also with us, Emma Winger, who is deputy legal director at the American Immigration Council. Both of you, thanks for being with us.
So, good to be here.
To take one thing off the table right away, when Mr. Trump said during that interview that we are the only country on the entire planet that has what is called, birthright citizenship, he's not correct about that, right?
No, he's incorrect. That is not true at all. There are about 34 other countries in the world, and notably our neighbors to the north and south, Canada and Mexico, both have provisions for birthright citizenship, as do many South American countries.
Okay. Now, the second part of what he said was that he intends on day one, that would be the 20th of January, I suppose, to get rid of it by executive order. Can he do that?
I think it would be a long shot for him to do so by executive order. Obviously, presidents have enormous powers, but their powers have to be exercised within the constraints of the United States Constitution. And as you've mentioned, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which was ratified in the wake of the American Civil War, provides in its first section that those born in the United States are citizens of the United States. It seems from Mr. Trump's Agenda 47 that The theory behind his plan is simply to say that birthright citizenship only extends to those individuals who are, quote unquote, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, and therefore those who are the children of undocumented migrants are not going to be included in that because their parents are not subject to the jurisdiction. That is a very novel legal approach. It is untested, a matter of first impression in our courts. And I think if he chooses to pursue it through an executive order, it will very quickly land in a legal challenge that will go through the federal courts.
Emma, I wonder what your thoughts are about this proposal by the president-elect to end birthright citizenship.
Well, you know, I think one thing worth pointing out is that obviously eliminating birthright citizenship would harm countless children, but it would also raise enormous practical difficulties, even if he could succeed, right? Right now, people born in the United States are not part of the immigration system because they are U.S. citizens. We get our passport, our birth certificate at birth, and that alone is enough to prove citizenship. But if he succeeded in eliminating birthright citizenship, the U.S. immigration system would be flooded with a generation of children, many of whom would be born without any status in the U.S. Children of even immigrants with lawful status wouldn't automatically gain citizenship, gain that status at birth. And certainly children of undocumented parents would generally be ineligible for any status, leading to a growing underclass of vulnerable children who have never lived in any other country and who claim America as their home. I think the last point I want to say is, of course, even U.S. citizen parents would presumably be forced to take an additional step to prove their own status and the citizenship of their children in a system that has not yet been created. So in other words, it's a burden that would fall on everyone.
We are talking with Melissa Murray, who teaches constitutional law at NYU. We are also talking with Emma Winger, who is deputy legal director at the American Immigration Council. Melissa, let's go back to you and go down a little bit farther the road that Trump suggests he is going to do, which is using an executive order to get rid of birthright citizenship. Can he do that retroactive? And if so, under what legal theory, or could he only do it going forward?
Well, this raises enormous questions. And again, this is a question of first impression. Let me go back to what I mentioned earlier. This is a provision of the 14th Amendment, the first section of the 14th Amendment. The fact that it's the first section makes clear that it was enormously important to those drafting and ratifying the 14th Amendment that birthright citizenship be established. And it was done so to officially and formally repudiate the Supreme Court's decision in 1857's Dred Scott versus Stanford. That was the case that held that African Americans who were descended from enslaved persons could never be citizens of the United States. So it was part of this post-Civil War settlement to bring Black people into the body politic. That history is critically important in thinking about this. Obviously, everyone is thinking about what this means for undocumented persons, but the lineage of this provision obviously includes a wider number of individuals, including racial and ethnic minorities who historically have been the subject of discrimination. It seems from the May 2023 video that Donald Trump posted on his campaign website that it's not likely that this could apply in the past. It seems like part of the proposal is that in order to qualify for birthright citizenship, someone has to have at least one parent who's a citizen or a legal U.S. resident to be eligible for birthright citizenship. That means that I think it's very difficult as a practical matter to be able to go back and take that away. I think there would be enormous due process challenges if it were to be retroactively applied. So it's likely to be applied going forward. But if he wants to apply it to the population of undocumented persons and their children here, then yes, that is a retroactive application. But it also then would extend, as Emma says, to everyone who is born to immigrant parents in this country. You would have to establish that your parents were either lawful residents or citizens at the time of your birth, one parent, in order to continue to be eligible and qualified as a citizen by birthright. So I think there are enormous practical challenges to this and a lot of legal challenges that certainly would be launched.
All right, Melissa, we have to take a quick break. We will be right back.
This is Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM.
Welcome back to the Monday edition of Countdown 2024. Along with Margaret Carrero, I'm Charles Feldman.
Emma Winger and Melissa Murray remain with us to finish off our examination of birthright citizenship and Donald Trump's promises to end it.
So, Emma, let's very quickly for the end bring this down a little bit more to earth in the sense that we've talked, Margaret and I, to, for example, DACA students who are very worried. Some of them, of course, are now adults and not even students. How concerned realistically should people be if one or both of their parents were not here legally, but they were born here?
Well, you know, I think Melissa pointed out there are some real hurdles to this sort of action that I think will be met with, I would expect, some strong rebukes from the court. I think in the end, if Trump were to do this, this would be decided by the Supreme Court. But, you know, there's strong Supreme Court precedent sort of on this, though, as Melissa says, not directly on point. You know, I think this to me feels like it's both frightening, but there are many litigators out there who are ready and able to put forth, you know, strong challenges to any effort from the Trump administration to do something like this.
Emma Winger, Deputy Legal Director at the American Immigration Council, Melissa Murray, teaching constitutional law at NYU. Thank you both for joining us.
Well, we're planning a really interesting show tomorrow. You don't want to miss it. If you do miss it, though, catch up on demand on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search Countdown 2024 and follow the show.